Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, September 14th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital and the hospital's minimally invasive gynecologic surgery program, led by doctors Anouk Lambers and Siobhan Hayden. SaratogaHospital.org to learn more. Joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. Amy Freeth, an endocrinologist with Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. If you have a question for Dr. Freeth, give us a call, and I advise you do it early. Medical Mondays can get a little crazy. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email your question to voxpop@wamc.org. But the number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Dr. Amy Freeth and your endocrinology calls coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Amy Freeth, an endocrinologist with Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Amy Freeth joined Dartmouth Hitchcock Putnam Physicians and Southwestern Vermont Medical Center's endocrinology practice in January. She completed a fellowship in endocrinology, diabetes, and metabolism at the University of Vermont and a residency in internal medicine at the Mary Imogene Bassett Hospital in Cooperstown, New York. Dr. Freeth received her medical degree from the SUNY Health Science Center at Syracuse and is certified by both the American Board of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism and the American Board of Internal Medicine. If you want to be a part of today's conversation, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Amy Freeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me today.
I'm just glad I got through your entire CV. Whew, very impressive stuff. Hey, for a minute, before we take calls, let's talk about this thing that I find very mysterious, and that is metabolism. How does the endocrine system, glands, affect metabolism? And you know, you always hear, oh, so-and-so, yeah, you know, that person's got a slow metabolism. What does that mean? Is it true or is it a myth? Explain.
Great question. Metabolism really is the state at which our body exists when it comes to just the way it functions, the way it digests food, the way it processes food and integrates energy either in or out. So metabolism is something you could be born with. Genetically, you could be born with a more rapid metabolism, which may mean that you tend to be thinner and can eat as much as you want, or you could be born with a slower metabolism, which may put you in a place where you may hold on to weight a little differently. So metabolism is something that could fluctuate. Yeah.
I mean, as a kid who was a fat kid, poor Ray's got a slow metabolism. So that was actually true? I thought that was just my parents saying,
A metabolism is something that you're born with and then is influenced by all of the exposures that we have either in utero or after we're born. It's based on the foods we eat, the environments we live in. It's an adaptation from our ancestors, how we've developed over years and years. And so it is really a real thing. It is certainly something that can be altered by diet and exercise, lifestyle things that change how we use energy in our body. And some of us store better, and some of us don't seem to need to store as much. And it is really a very individualized process.
Why is it so individualized, Dr. Freeth? In other words, all those glands, they all perform the same function in every human, right?
Sure. I think the biggest thing would be related to how do we survive in the world, and that has a lot to do with how our ancestors survived in the world. And so if you looked at certain populations, and probably one of the best studied is the Pacific Islanders, who lived on islands and ate from the ocean and with the land around them, they had to travel long distances. And so those ancestors had to hold on to fat and energy for those long voyages to the islands and then survive on what they had. And nowadays, now that so they became very good at storing, and the ones that survived were very good stores. And now you have situations in which that food is readily available, energy is readily available, and so we see high rates of obesity and high rates of diabetes because their ancestors didn't have all of that food, and now all of a sudden that we do. So we have not yet adapted to having all of that energy around. And that's kind of what's happening all over. That's just a very specific example of that. Whether you came from the colonists, on the Mayflower, or you came from an African environment, or whatever environment our ancestors came from, there was periods of time where we had less food available, and it was really all about survival. So we upregulated those survival genes. And now we have abundance, and food is more available. We don't have to move as much. We don't have to go out and hunt and gather. We have to, just go to the grocery store. And so all of that will affect our metabolism.
We're joined today.
But we're kind of stuck with those basic.
Yeah, but still it comes down to diet and exercise more than anything, right?
Right.
Dr. Amy
comes
Freeth
down to how we live our lives.
Joins us today. She is an endocrinologist with Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. If you have a question about endocrinology, diabetes, metabolism, give us a call, 800-348-2551. What is the one biggest mystery left to solve when you are studying metabolism in humans?
Oh, the one big mystery. I think it would have to be human behavior. I think how we can help people alter that behavior to optimize their metabolism into a way that promotes health, that state of being that is health versus that state of being that leads down that path of disease and suffering.
We talk about
how do we switch that?
We talk about diet and exercise a moment ago, and during this lockdown, and many states have been locked down for 6 months now, and I assume people are getting out and about now. The rail trails seem busy, but there was a time when a lot of people were just in their house. Did we see a spike, or have we seen a spike recently going back several months of diabetes and similar illnesses?
I'm not sure that we know that yet. I can tell you from my practice that I saw two things. I saw people who either embraced the time and said, okay, well, I don't have to go to work. I'm going to cook and plan my meals, and I'm going to have regular exercise, and I'm going to get out and walk. And then I saw the opposite, and it could have happened to the same people, but the opposite happened where people really kind of went into that survival mode, were eating more, were less active, just staying in. And so it's really hard to know. I believe we will likely see a spike in metabolic diseases. People also didn't necessarily get to their doctors or were afraid to come into the hospital or afraid to kind of get care during the COVID isolation. And so they may have not gotten the care that they needed during that time or not the prescriptions they needed. And so there is a concern that we could see chronic diseases really kind of decompensate a little bit during that time.
Let's take a quick break here. Dr. Amy Freeth is our guest, an endocrinologist with Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll get to your calls coming up. Yes, it's the haunting theme from Picnic here on a Medical Monday. Sure, it's not appropriate, but what the heck? We are talking about endocrinology today. Dr. Amy Freeth joins us from Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Lorene is in Hoosick Falls. Lorene, you're on.
Hello.
Hi, Dr. Fries. I have a question about endocrinology, and given our area and the severe contamination we've been exposed to with PFAS chemicals, are you up to date on the PFAS conditions related to that contamination and endocrine, such as diabetes, obesity, thyroid, and all of that? Because our communities are in dire need of physician guidance on this topic.
Great question. The concept of endocrine disruptors in our environment is a pretty big topic in endocrinology and is just getting bigger. I will say that it is certainly something that I'm very interested in as far as looking at that more. I have to be honest that I have to look at the specific chemicals that you're talking about with regards to specific diseases. One of the things that I'm aware of when it comes to endocrine disrupting chemicals that are in our environment is they affect everyone in a little bit of a different way, and exposures can be very different. It is certainly something that I'm interested in. I did a lot when I was looking at fracking with regards to those kind of chemicals. So I can't tell you specifically which diseases or exposures people may be having with regards to that, but it is certainly something that I'll be looking into.
All right, Lorene, thanks a lot for the call. We're joined today by Dr. Amy Freeth on this Medical Monday. What did you learn when you were looking at the chemicals involved with fracking?
Well, it's very interesting. So endocrine disruptors are chemicals in our environment that can affect the endocrine system, which is very nonspecific. But one of the things that was very interesting was that very low exposures can have profound effects, where larger exposures may not. And so when these chemicals are in our environment and we have even small exposures, they can affect different glands. They can also affect different glands. So if you were exposed, it may affect your thyroid, and if I were exposed, it may affect my adrenal glands. So very difficult to say this chemical does this or that chemical does this specifically. It can be very diverse and very hard to be able to say, yes, that's what caused it. But clearly what I learned was that we really need to protect our environment with regards to what we put into it, not only because it affects us as humans and can cause disease, but can also affect the environment around us, the animals, the plants, which does really change our environment. And they're not chemicals that we can necessarily get out. We can do cleanups and we can do those kind of things, and we should, but they're not necessarily something we can clean up 100%. And it does cause contamination, whether it's to our children or adults, throughout the lifetime. And so we really do have to pay attention to those.
We're joined today by Dr. Amy Freeth of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551 on this Medical Monday. Jim is in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Craig. How does a vegetarian diet affect the incidence of diabetes type 2?
Great question, Jim. Thank you. So vegetarian diet, I would refer to that more as a plant-based diet. We definitely know has health benefits. Type 2 diabetes tends to be related more to insulin resistance and weight gain. So some of it depends on how people do with regards to the vegetarian diet. I have seen people start vegetarian diets who then eat more grains and more carbohydrates and then can gain weight. And then I see people who are vegetarians who then really do tend to eat a lot of vegetables. And we know vegetables are have a lot of nutrition, have a lot of properties, and can replenish the body, can activate receptors that help us overcome some of the insulin resistance And so a plant-based diet is very good for the body. A Mediterranean type diet, whether you add in a little protein or not, it has been shown to be probably one of the best diets for diabetes type 2. So I think the vegetarian diet is something that I would advocate for if it was something that somebody felt that they valued and wanted to try, as long as they didn't add in more of the grains and more of the sugars or processed foods. So it's more about eating those whole foods, the whole vegetables, the whole grains, good healthy fats that really do benefit somebody with type 2 diabetes as opposed to the processed foods. So I would advocate for a vegetarian diet as long as you're also getting in some of the other nutrients that you might be missing. So the vitamin B12 that we tend to get from animal products, which I think you can get from nutritional yeast, you know, things like that, just making sure that you know what you're missing in your diet and that you're getting ample amounts of nutrition.
All right, Jim, thank you very much for the call. It's Medical Monday with Dr. Amy Freeth, an endocrinologist with Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. And now we go over to Great Barrington and Barbara. Barbara, you're up.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been diagnosed with hyperparathyroidism many years ago, and they diagnosed me with secondary hyperparathyroidism because I had a kidney taken out in 2003 for kidney cancer, and I'm fine now, but now my PTH levels are high in the 200s, and now it was now they told me that I have primary hyperparathyroidism. So I'm a little bit confused about that. Can you explain each one?
Yeah.
And what's
sure.
my next step? Thank you.
Sure. So I will agree with you that can get very complicated. So be gentle yes. with yourself. So primary hyperparathyroidism means that at least one of four of your parathyroid glands, which live in your neck near your thyroid, they don't have yes. anything to do with your thyroid, but they live near the thyroid.
Right.
So one of those, at least one, it can be more than one, has decided to misbehave and decided to make too much of what we call PTH, which is parathyroid hormone. And when it does mm-hmm. that, it tells the body to increase the calcium level. So it takes calcium from the bone, it absorbs more calcium through the stomach, and it reabsorbs more calcium from the kidney. And that raises the calcium level. And so primary hyperparathyroidism is a high PTH with a high calcium level. Because normally, if your calcium was high, your PTH level would be very low, if at all detectable. So typically what happens is you would go in and you would have surgery to remove one of those parathyroid glands, whichever one was misbehaving, and that would be typically a surgical cure.
Right.
Secondary hyperparathyroidism means it's not coming from the parathyroid gland. It's coming from other reasons, and there are several reasons. One can be chronic kidney disease or having a kidney removed, yes. or then you only have one kidney that's responding. And so we do know that in people who have kidney disease, the parathyroid glands function very differently, and we can see high PTH levels. But in those situations, the calcium level remains normal. Okay? Other things that can cause secondary hyperparathyroidism is vitamin D deficiency. And so in vitamin D deficiency, the parathyroid hormone goes high because the calcium level is starting to grow. And so it's appropriately starting to go lower. So it's appropriately trying to elevate the calcium levels in the body because calcium needs to stay at a very specific level. So if we replace
yeah.
the vitamin D, the parathyroid will come down. And vitamin D tends to be very important in the kidney disease piece of it as well, and that's a little bit more complicated. So the way you would know that if it was primary hyperparathyroidism was if the calcium level was too high, and secondary hyperparathyroidism yeah. is if the calcium was normal or at the lower end of normal. So it does get a little complicated in that situation. That would probably be a consultation to discuss and look at all of the labs, because it would be very hard for me to tell you what else was going on. But that's the differentiation between the two.
Barbara, thank you very much for the call. It's Medical Monday with Dr. Amy Freeth from Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. Our number here, and there's still one or two open lines, 800-348-2551. Let's go to Frederick in Colony. Frederick.
Yes, I've been diagnosed about 20 years now with this. He calls it the thyroid. It's not. It's low. And where should I go? I have no idea. I never went to one. I tried to go to an endocrinologist, but I haven't found the right one. How can I go about looking for a good endocrinologist? I wish you were a little closer. I would, you know, give you a shot, you know, just to see if, you know, if that's what my problem is or if it's something else.
Okay.
So, Frederick, the question is, how do you find an endocrinologist?
And how do you pick one out, and how do you, you know, to get, you know, the endocrinologist to look at everything? I don't think they're looking, you know, they just keep going with the thyroid, but is there something else that's, you know, I'm having trouble with the medication. That's my biggest thing right now. It's playing on me to a degree with the side effects. And I just kind of, I don't know what to do.
Okay.
Gotcha.
All right.
Okay.
Doctor.
Thank you, Fred. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that like any doctor that you're going to choose, it's a relationship, right? So even though we're in this world of technology and computers, having a doctor, whether it's an endocrinologist or a primary care doctor, is really about having a good relationship. And the one thing that has changed in medicine is that we really have forgotten that. Are forgotten or tend to forget or tend to not put enough emphasis on the fact that we need to listen to people and that we need to have a conversation and we have to have mutual respect for one another. And so there are clearly people who come and don't necessarily like the way that I practice medicine and there are some people who love that way. And so it's important to interview your doctors. It's important to go not with the emphasis that I'm going to the doctor and that has to be my doctor. It's the person that you can talk to. It's the person that you feel listened to. It's the person that you have respect for. And I think that that's the important thing. Some of the issue in endocrinology is there's not a lot of us out there. There's not enough of us out there, and we're very, okay. very busy. And so it's sometimes hard to get in. And so patience is part of that. But I do think that you have to start from the beginning. This is my story. This is what I've been through. This is what works. This is what doesn't work. And then to have really good understanding of what it is that is going on with you so that you feel confident in the medications. And then the rest of it is just an art. How do we tweak the medication? How do we maybe pick a different formulation such that it works for your individual needs and whatnot? And there are... Sometimes there are other things that are going on. The thyroid gets blamed for a lot of things, and so making sure we don't get so focused that it's the thyroid and not look for other things.
Frederick, thanks a lot for the call. Well, Dr. Freeth, you made a great point about interviewing your potential doctor. Now let me flip that on its head. Hippocratic oath notwithstanding. You ever get that patient where you say, good Lord, this person's a pain in the backside. I want no part of this.
Well, we always have, you know, it really is a relationship, and some relationships are not always easy, and it tends to be related to misunderstandings or just different philosophies or values. And I believe that you, if you're going to come to see me as a patient, that you have to value the type of medicine that I practice. You have to value what it is I have to say, but it doesn't mean that you have to do what I say. It just means that we have to be on that same level of communication with regards to that. It is frustrating at times when I know that I'm making some recommendations that will help people not suffer, and they continue to do the things that make them suffer. But at the same time, I have that respect that person's an individual and it's their body and they get to make these decisions. But I don't feel like I'm in charge of them, right? I think for a long time, especially in diabetes, the doctors took ownership. This is going back to the time of when we discovered insulin. We took ownership of that we somehow had to protect people, and they had to come into the hospital, and we had to give them insulin. And so we kind of took that on. But diabetes, which we do a lot of in endocrinology, really is that person's diabetes. And I shouldn't necessarily own the tools or have all the power over giving you the tools. I should just be there to assist you in using the tools so that you understand them. And that's a big problem in our society today, is that the tools are all locked up in insurance prior authorizations, and you can't get this medicine, but you can get this one, and it gets very confusing, and we can't really use the tools that we can for people. And so those are the kind of the big things, is to understand maybe where the problems are and where they're not. And I think that, you know, we have to have a good relationship with our doctor, and we have to have that mutual respect. Some people come in and say, just tell me what to do. That's what I'm here for. And in that situation, I can respect that. And I say, this is what you should do. And some people come in and they just want my opinion, and they want to decide what they want to do, and I have to respect that's their choice, and that's their understanding, and I'm here to guide them and journey with them through whatever it is they're going through, but not necessarily to just own all of that for them.
Dr. Amy,
and that's where real health begins. That's just where real health begins.
Dr. Amy Freeth is our guest from Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. Let's grab one more call here, and then we'll take a brief break and then hit the home stretch. Let's go to Bernie in Hopewell Junction. Bernie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I am 55, and about 15 years ago I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's, and I'm on Armour Thyroid because I didn't convert to T3 or T4, I can't remember which. So that's already broken down, and I tend to do better on that than on the Synthroid. The issue I'm dealing with since my 40s is a cystic acne that is unresponsive to any treatment short of steroids and antibiotics. My testosterone is normal. Everything seems to come out normal. But this coincided with my thyroid disease, and I don't know who else to turn to. Nobody seems to solve it.
Thank you, Bernie. So I have to be honest, I'm not aware of Hashimoto's thyroiditis or Armour thyroid contributing to acne. It's good that they test your testosterone. I do think a good dermatologist can be helpful. I know that there is very resistant acne out there, and it may or may not be hormonal. It may be more inflammatory. So anti-inflammatory type things like anti-inflammatory diets. I've seen things written about turmeric, which are supplements that help reduce inflammation. But I'm not aware of any thyroid contribution to the acne. And you may notice,
okay,
now you're into your 50s, that you may notice that that hormonally things are changing, and that could improve spontaneously.
Unfortunately, I think you hit the nail on the head with the inflammation. Because it all seems to stem around a hair follicle rather than acne. Mm-hmm. I've gone so far as to try Accutane. Nothing works, so they think that it's not even acne, that it may be a cystic response to hair follicles.
Right. So there are disorders specific to the hair follicle, and certainly the right diagnosis can make all the difference in the world. So if it's not responding to things, acne, I would say most of the time responds to Accutane. So if it's not, maybe the proper diagnosis needs to be made. Thinking outside that box of what else could it be, so that you can address it in a different way.
All right, Bernie, we have to take a break here. Dr. Amy Freeth is our guest.
Thank you.
And let's take a break now. We'll hit the home stretch. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Dr. Amy Freeth of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center is here to discuss endocrinology. And two emails here, doctor. You may have to help me sort of figure this one out. I think there are some typos. But here we go. This one is from Kate. My mom has a thyroid issue. She takes
levothyroxine.
Perhaps. There's a lot of dots here, a lot of ellipses. Yep. She takes it every morning. She has recently been diagnosed with Lewy body disease and or Parkinson's dementia. She's no longer able to make health decisions and forgets her health history and practitioners. We have not been to the endocrinologist since her dementia became severe back in June. Should I prioritize this visit? What, if any, questions I should be asking relating to endocrinology and LBDPDD, which you can tell me what that is, too, because I have no idea.
Sure.
All right.
LBD is Lewy body dementia, and the PD is Parkinson's dementia.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
So the
question Kate is asking is her mother has hypothyroidism and is on levothyroxine, which is thyroid hormone replacement therapy, and she's been recently diagnosed with some form of dementia.
Right. Severe Parkinson's dementia.
Yeah. So the question would be is there anything else that could be contributing to that from an endocrine standpoint, and how does that relate to the thyroid? I would say that this is likely a different process and not related to the thyroid. But the thyroid is important to maintain in the normal range. So it'll be important for Kate, for your mom to be able to take her medication reliably, whether or not she'll need assistance with that. Sometimes working with an endocrinologist or a primary care doctor, there are different ways that you could take it that maybe make it a little bit easier in this situation. Because if the thyroid becomes underactive, it will contribute to the memory loss. It will contribute to the dementia symptoms.
Hmm.
And so it's not necessarily causative, but if you allow the thyroid to become underactive, it can exacerbate some of those findings.
Okay. All right. Let's go to this one from Mark. Mark writes, what role, if any, does the endocrine system play in the regulation of blood pressure or perhaps hypertension? And that is from Mark.
Yeah, great question. So the endocrine system has a huge role in the regulation of blood pressure. Remember that the endocrinology system is the messengers. It's the glands that send the messages to the rest of the body. And so the body is always in communication with itself. And it's through the endocrine process that it will send messages to blood vessels, to the heart, to sensing where the blood pressure is and needing it to stay in that range. So it's a very intricate system between the endocrine system, the nervous system, and the vascular system to maintain blood pressure. So there are different endocrine diseases that can lead to very severe blood pressure. So we call these secondary causes of high blood pressure. So certain adrenal hormones can lead to very high blood pressure. There's both the internal and the external adrenal glands. All of those hormones are intimately related to that. But if any of those are out of balance in a way that there's a adrenal tumor or whatnot, you can see very severe high blood pressure. Now, fortunately, those are very rare, and we don't see them as often. But if blood pressure is very hard to control, we look for those. the other endocrine hormones that are very involved with the regulation of blood pressure happen through the adrenal gland and through the kidney. And so there's monitoring there of how much blood flow is going through the kidneys and how high the blood pressure needs to be to perfuse the kidneys and the rest of the body. So the question becomes, is there a problem with the endocrine? Is there a disease with the endocrine system that's leading to the high blood pressure? Or is it just that the body is responding in a certain way that's leading to high blood pressure? The higher salt diets or the stress being a big one. How is your body adapting to the environment that you're living in that's leading to things like high blood pressure? So it's a great question. It's a complicated question. And certainly something that if you feel that there's something's just not right and it's not acting as a typical high blood pressure that people get just as we age, then I think it is worth kind of looking into to see if there are things that we can treat.
All right, let's go back to the phones with Dr. Amy Freeth, endocrinologist with Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. And looks like Terry in Lenox is next. Terry.
Oh, yeah, hi. I'm a retired primary care physician in my mid-80s now. Had a problem with my weight most of my life. I had to stop practicing with a medical misadventure of a cerebral hemorrhage about 23 years ago. Oh. But first of all, I want to really vigorously second your talk about the importance of relationship with the patient. I think it's vital. But and I also want to commend you on a very impressive CV and apparent real knowledge of your field and the ability to really transmit that in a clear, understandable way. But I don't want to open a can of worms. I tuned into the program late. Don't know whether you've hit this, but I'm curious as to your thoughts about, you know, the current rage of keto, low-carb diets, and intermittent fasting and so forth.
Great.
Some years ago, I went on Atkins and was successful. And with the whole business of improving lipids, et cetera, and then tried low carb in the fall. It works for a while, but I'm interested in your reaction to it. I find now that when I lose weight at this age, I tend to be losing muscle mass, and I'm going to end up looking like a skeleton with a beer belly. But anyway, I'd still like to
work. Thanks for that image, Terry. I appreciate it. All right, Dr. Freeth, go ahead.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you for your comments, too. This is a great question. It's a big question, and I'm not even sure that endocrinologists or the field of endocrinology or cardiometabolic field really knows all the answers to this. It seems like diets have been, you know, the mainstay of the questions that we ask. How is it that we eat to either change our metabolism, change our state, or to reverse disease? And I think that that's it may very well be an individual answer. However, we know that ketogenic diets work for weight loss, and we know that they actually can have a profound effect on diabetes. And so there is a company out there that actually coaches people through the ketogenic diet, and sometimes in some places insurance will cover it. And they have really great results with regards to changing weight and changing blood sugar numbers, improving glycemic control. I think the problem with the ketogenic diet is that we weren't meant to be in ketosis our entire existence. And so they're very hard to continue on forever. And I think in order for them to be effective, it is almost a forever thing, or a forever thing where you are following your diet and very slowly transitioning back into eating certain foods that may take you out of ketosis. You brought up intermittent fasting, and I think there is really great data on fasting. We talked earlier about our ancestors, and most of our ancestors spent a good amount of their time in a fasted state. And so we're learning that metabolism is affected affected on not just what we eat, but when we eat, so that we are really part of that circadian rhythm of the day, this, you know, sun up to sundown. And so we're finding with things like intermittent fasting, meaning that we either fast once a week or twice, 2 days a week, or that we eat from maybe, say, 11 to 7 and then not eat for a longer period of time and prolong that fast, that we're seeing great metabolic benefits, people having a weight loss that's a little bit more sustainable, where they can eat what they want to eat during the rest of the hours, but if they're having that prolonged fast where they may even go into ketosis overnight, is a very normal process that our bodies are used to. And if you look at even the data around more prolonged fasting, So we're seeing these fast mimicking diets where you're actually eating, but eating very small amount of carb, very small amount of protein. It actually changes the cellular genetics, not the changes the genetics, but upregulates the genetics that allow us to be more resilient. Our cells are healthier. They're able to fight disease more when we're not eating and when we're fasting. And we're able to have a stem cell response. There's a real rejuvenation that happens with fasting, and that's part of our evolution as human beings. And so I'm not advocating that when you're in your 80s, because it is true that you could lose too much muscle, and that will affect weakness and will affect, your muscle function. And so we have to be really very careful with this. But I think as we move forward, we're going to find that balance of eating more whole foods, more foods that we grow ourselves, which is, I think, happened a lot in COVID. And we're going to find that eating less during the day in a 24-hour period is what we're really looking for, as opposed to the extremes of a ketogenic diet or certain diets that are just harder for us to maintain over time.
Well, Terry, thank you very much for a great call. Dr. Amy Freeth is our guest. And Dr. Freeth, we only have about 4 minutes here or so let's get to a couple of more calls. Jesse and Troy. Jesse, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So in kind of an ongoing quest to do what's best for our bodies and best also for the earth, my family and I are kind of slowly moving towards a more plant-based diet. And as we do that, I noticed that we're eating a lot more soy products to replace milk now, and now mostly soy milk and tofu. And I've heard various kind of anecdotal things about phytoestrogens in soy, and some people think it's a big deal, and some people think it's not, and I was wondering if you could weigh in on that.
Okay. Did you catch any of that, Dr. Freeth?
I think I got most of it.
Okay.
The question mostly being around soy products,
yeah,
and health and phytoestrogens. A phytoestrogen is really it can be part of a lot of different vegetables, but soy we know has phytoestrogens in them. They're natural estrogens that are in plants. And so the question is if estrogen is a precursor for things like breast cancer, certain hormonal cancers, are they good for us or are they not good for us? And I think the biggest thing that I can say about this is that any whole food that you eat, so if you ate, say, edamame, which has, which is soy, right? It is the soybean. You're getting all of the products in the soybean that you need to metabolize that, to support that, to use it in your body. It's when we break down the soy into these soy isolates or these soy byproducts, where we break down soy and we break down the protein such that we change it or we're not getting the full piece of it, then we do have to worry a little bit that we could be getting too much of it. And so I haven't really looked at the research specifically on soy recently, but the basis that I had was that people in Japan eat whole soy, and so we see less breast cancers, we see less cancers, hormonal cancers, in Japan, where in the United States we tend to eat more of the isolates. So the more you can go into a whole product for soy, I think that that's fine. So just, I don't necessarily think I would avoid it, but if there were specific reasons why you might, if somebody had a breast cancer or a prostate cancer or hormonally driven cancer, maybe I would avoid the soy a little bit more. But the whole, any kind of whole product is always going to be better.
All right, Jesse, thanks very much for the call. All right, Dr. Freeth, we have about, just under 2 minutes here, so let's grab one more call. When you hear Count Basie play the piano, we're almost done with the show. Diane in Austerlitz. Diane, you're on.
Hi, I hope you can hear me without breaking up.
Sure.
I have a family member, a young adult, early 20s, suffered a TBI from a street attack in 2014, another brain injury from a bad bicycle accident in 2016, and still has lots of sequelae, and is convinced that testosterone therapy would help with lingering problems of cognitive function, brain fog, low energy, and so forth. We went to a doctor in Pittsburgh who specifically believes that supporting testosterone will help with TBI, Valerie Donaldson.
Okay.
And that's about as far as we got.
All right, we only have about 30 seconds. Can we distill this down into a quick question? Go ahead.
Testosterone and TBI.
Okay. Dr. Freeth.
Yeah. So I'm going to give you, I believe that you have to be very careful with testosterone. So if the TBI caused pituitary damage, which leads to low testosterone, then clearly we should replace the testosterone. If the testosterone function and that access from the pituitary to the testes is normal and it's making testosterone, then we have to be very careful not to give people too much testosterone because it certainly can cause some harm. And so I think that it really requires working with somebody who's used to using testosterone, and we don't use so much just because somebody feels better,
yeah,
because then we can be causing harm elsewhere.
Well, Dr. Amy Freeth, we are out of time. Great. What a superb job. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
Hopefully we'll talk to you soon. Support comes from Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, helping fight the epidemic opiate crisis both locally and throughout the country with specialized programs, education, and support for men, women, and families. VillaVeritas.org for inquiries. Once again, thanks to Dr. Amy Freeth of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center for being here. A fantastic job. Terrific calls. Apologies if we did not get to your call. Hopefully we will have Dr. Freeth back in the future. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who I suspect will be back at the controls tomorrow. Joe Makowicz took the calls. Our engineer, of course, Zach Malloy, I mentioned him. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Birding with Rich Guthrie. Stand by for the Media Project right now.